This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 70th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am pleased to have with me today Ross Anderson. Hi, Ross.
Hi.
In a first for Silver Bullet, we're making an explicit attempt to break a long-held total downloads record set by Ross himself with over 25,000 downloads of episode 13, which originally aired on April 13th, 2007. So who better to beat this venerable record than Ross himself? Ross Anderson is a professor of security engineering at Cambridge, where he leads the computer security group. Ross has the distinction of having written and revised the best security book of all time, Security Engineering. In addition to his academic credentials, Ross consults regularly to industry and does what he can to keep the bankers in line with well-aimed presents. Ross is an outspoken defender of academic freedom, intellectual property, and computational liberty. Thanks for joining us, Ross.
Well, thanks for the kind words, Gary.
My pleasure. It's great to have you back. Back in 2003, in the Wayback Machine, there were major raging debates over trusted computing. What are the latest developments in this area, and do all our bases belong to mega corporations already?
Well, there's been concern recently that the UEFI specification is going to require PC motherboards to be built in such a way that they'll only run signed operating systems. And of course, as you would imagine, Microsoft is very, very keen on this, and the Linux community is considerably less keen. Mm-hmm. Now, it's going to take some time to work out what all the precise implications are, but we can see a number of the ideas, some of the potential benefits, and many of the prospective downsides of the trusted computing debate coming around again in a slightly different guise.
Mm-hmm. So it looks like the same thing, but only 7 years later, more or less.
It's the same thing coming around again. And in the meantime, we understand an awful lot more about how difficult it is to do things like certification. Now, if operating systems are going to have to be signed, then who's going to control the certification hierarchy? Mm-hmm. Is it going to be any of the 600-odd available commercial CAs? In which case, you can be absolutely sure that the malware vendors will compromise some of them, mm-hmm. just as the Iranian secret police have compromised some of them. Mm-hmm. And my prediction is that exactly the same dynamics which broke the CA infrastructure will also break UEFI. Hmm. Let me give you an example. One of the things that broke the CA infrastructure was that every country wanted to have its own CA,
right.
so that it could certify Gmail, for example, to be the front end run for Gmail interception by its own secret police. Mm-hmm. And this was done routinely in countries like Tunisia, and also in more developed countries. Now, when you start talking about preventing malware being installed on the machine, that's another favorite law enforcement trick. And there are some countries like Germany that rely on it very heavily. So if UEFI is going to insist that all operating systems are signed, the German government is going to insist that the keys they use for signing their malware will also be signed.
Right.
And the British government will insist, and the French government will insist, and the Japanese and the American, and so on and so forth.
And pretty soon you'll have a huge trusted base, so to speak.
Exactly so. You'll find that, as with the browser, there are several hundred CAs, including one in the pay of just about every major government, which are allowed to sign stuff, and they'll be signing malware, official malware, and before the world is very much older, they'll be signing bad malware as well.
So, you know, this sounds to me like the same equilibrium that we always get to, no matter what we try to do on a positive or a negative sense in security. You've talked about this, I know, in your own work, but this notion of an equilibrium in security that seems to be fairly persistent over time is coming up a lot lately. Can trusted computing, you think, do anything to break that equilibrium, or does it really matter? Is another way of thinking about that.
Well, one way of thinking about this is that these are fundamentally governance problems. And it's not just UEFI, for example. What about the control of the internet? Who's going to control the major transit providers? What happens if they shake out? What happens if, you know, some kind of oligopoly emerges? Mm-hmm. All these fundamentally come down to a problem which you might, in fact, relate to the public goods problem.
Right.
Now, economists consider goods that are non-rival and non-excludable to be public goods. Examples are clean air, scientific research, protection of the environment, global financial stability. There are all sorts of things which either we all enjoy or none of us enjoy. Mm-hmm. And the history of civilization is largely a history of producing public goods, starting off 10,000 years ago with security, because once we invented agriculture, we had food surpluses. And so, we had stuff to guard. It was suddenly a good idea for you to set up in the business of being a roving brigand and to go around and steal people's food from their granaries. And then people had to invent governments. They had to invent at least chieftains who would be the static brigand who would extract a tax from everybody in the village and in return protect the grain store. And as our societies became more and more complex, so we needed to find mechanisms for providing an ever greater range and diversity of public goods. Things like scientific research, for example, for which we've set up things like universities and national funding councils and so on and so forth. And now that we're building an ever more complex society, there's a problem of how do you provide global public goods without a global government?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the fundamental problem at the heart of the cybercrime problem, at the heart of the certification problem, and at the heart of many other problems which bedevil the online world.
And a tough nut to crack, definitely.
Indeed so. And so what's happening up till now is that essentially everybody is free riding off the good old US of A. If you look at expenditures on cyber crime, for example, America spends about $100 million a year mm-hmm. between the FBI, the Secret Service, and the NCFTA. The rest of the advanced countries probably spend about that much between us. It's the same as it is in defense, where America spends as much on defense as the next half dozen nations put together.
And in fact, if you look at what Russia has to say about cyber crime, they have a very interesting way of twisting that to talk about dissent instead of actual crime. So international norms are vastly different.
Well, Russia and China are at the moment the main freeloaders, although some other countries like Brazil are to a certain extent. But this, again, is something that we've seen before. Back in the 16th century, for example, the king of Spain was the hegemon. He was the person who kept down the Barbary pirates. And the up-and-coming new countries, like Britain, tweaked his tail by making alliances with the corsairs and breaking his monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an old, old pattern that's repeating itself.
Yeah, very interesting. So obviously you remain very dedicated to the subfield of economics and security for all the reasons you've just stated. Can you explain briefly the relevance of Axelrod's iterated prisoner's dilemma exercise and relate that to computer security in terms of dynamical systems and systems that feed back on themselves?
Well, the prisoner's dilemma is the dilemma that if you've got a couple of guys, Alfie and Benji, are arrested by the police on suspicion of doing a bank robbery, the police take them aside and say, look, Alfie, if you confess to the crime, you'll get off free, provided Benji doesn't. And if he confesses to the crime and you don't, well, then he'll go off free and you'll get 10 years. If you both confess, we'll give you 5 years each. And if neither of you confesses, we'll give you a year for possessing an unlicensed firearm. Now, acting separately, Alfie and Benji will both reckon that it's in their best interest to confess.
Mm-hmm.
So they end up doing 5 years when, in fact, they could have kept stum and done 1 year. And this is a very, very good example of the fact that often it's in our interest to coordinate. Now, the same mechanism as you find in fisheries, in the prisoner's dilemma, you find in fisheries protection, you find in the protection of systems online and many other places. Now, what Axelrod did was to ask whether you can fix this if people know that the game will be played again and again and again.
Exactly. So you turn it on, so to speak.
Exactly so. And what they found when they ran this was that if Prisoner's Dilemma was played repeatedly between individuals, the strategy that eventually emerged as the strongest overall was tit for tat. Mm-hmm. And in tit for tat, the strategy is that I'll believe you first time round, I'll trust you first time round, but ever after, I'm going to do to you on this round what you did to me in the last round.
Right.
So if you cooperate with me this round, I'll cooperate next round. But if you screw me this round, I'll screw you next round.
Yeah, beautiful piece of work, actually, and really changed the face of economic theory in my perspective. Now let's relate that to computer security.
Well, what was shown is that the iterated prisoner's dilemma appears to underlie a fair amount of animal behavior, in that animals have learned over evolutionary periods of time to adopt tit-for-tat strategies of trust the other animal the first time and thereafter have a strategy of strict revenge, are embedded in our DNA. They're embedded in the way we think deep down. Why? Because these are viable, because these work. Mm-hmm. So it is conceivable that you start building this into systems, and there are a number of areas in which such strategies start being deployed, in peer-to-peer systems, for example, mm-hmm. where if somebody uploads a bit, you'll trust them and let them download a bit. Now, trying to take that across unvarnished into information security may require a little bit of caution, because if you're in an adversarial environment where the other guy can observe what you do and is modifying his software, his strategy all the time, then things may be not quite so straightforward as they are in the natural world.
Just because the system changes between clock ticks, so to speak.
And there's a whole other area of research which is still really in its infancy, which is how do you deal with systems that are very dynamic, mm-hmm. where the topology of the system, and in fact even the rules of the system, change on the same kind of timescale as the transactions that you're trying to observe or to protect.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So I want to push on that a little bit. So in any dynamical system, there are multiple attractors, if you want to use the kind of chaos theory nomenclature. I guess an attractor in the iterated prisoner's dilemma might be the tit-for-tat strategy, if we squint and do a low-res view of the nomenclature. So the idea of security equilibrium is probably just our way of describing an attractor, that is, some sort of steady state that we tend to reach. So are we doomed to pretty much suffer from the same amount of security risk no matter what we do?
Well, I might put it somewhat differently, that as the technology package that we've got available to us changes, so also the frontier of possibilities for profitable transactions in the economic sense or pleasurable transactions in the human sense mm-hmm. also changes. And so people are going to explore this frontier, and where you get into sinkholes, where a lack of cooperation dooms everything to a tragedy of the commons, mm-hmm. then ultimately people won't go there, and those will end up being missed opportunities, unless, of course, some external force, such as perhaps a government with regulation or taxes or whatever, or a dominant service provider, can end up imposing some structure of rules which makes it profitable for people to trade there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then you get back to your new equilibrium, I suppose.
Yeah, so in this, I suspect that the proper role of governments isn't trying to displace markets, which governments have a terrible tendency to try and do, but to try and ensure that they create markets where a little bit of assistance from a government is what's missing for that market to come into existence.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that concerns me at the moment, for example, is how do we go about hooking up smart grids and smart meters to appliances in the home. Because at present, the world of electricity is very much divvied up into stovepipes. The different electricity retailers do their own thing.
Right.
The different appliance vendors do their thing. So Philips has got a way to talk to appliances, and LG's got a way to talk to appliances, and so on. And if we are going to hook up grids to appliances in a smart way, so that we can respond in real time to changes of price, which signal, you know, whether windmills are turning in Idaho or whatever, then you need to create not just the communications mechanisms and computational platforms, you also need to create the market.
Right.
And for that...
And you have to protect it from being cornered and skewed by, you know, obvious attackers.
Exactly so. And many of the system firms that would try and get into this market would try and do so. If you read their prospectuses, it's very, very blatant. You know, we want to be the Microsoft of smart energy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're going to let one firm capture all the surplus there, you can't expect much innovation to happen. So here, I suspect the role of governments is to promote open platforms. And what I'd like to see would be a platform similar to the Apache web server, which would enable people to hook up different types of appliances to their meters, to the electricity infrastructure,
mm-hmm.
because fundamentally it's a web browser that you need in order to use your smartphone to find out what temperature your thermostat's set at, and, for example, tell your boiler not to turn on until 9 o'clock when you're going to come home.
So is that the sort of market intervention that you think governments are suited for? Because I'm a little worried about that.
Well, that's... Given the way that energy markets in Europe are regulated, it may take some government action to enable that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we can get together the necessary open platform, then, of course, the platform could be used in different ways in different markets.
Right.
The USA, of course, has got its own energy market regulation, but it tends to run differently.
Right. And you pointed out one of the problems is that the commons are not really a commons in some sense because there are many different vendors who own different parts of the grid. And right now they're cooperating, but only because they have to in order to survive. But they're not cooperating from an information perspective, really. So
that's right. So there's a logjam here that has to be broken somehow.
Yeah, and it's an interesting one because compartmentalization has always been very important to security as a tactic, you know. But compartmentalization runs counter to this notion of creating a commons that we are all working to build as a market. And I want to push on compartmentalization a little bit. So let's just switch over to WikiLeaks, right? So let's talk about compartmentalization and WikiLeaks.
One of the things that we noticed after 9/11 was that the compartments that had traditionally separated the U.S. intelligence community and which had divided up other intelligence communities as well were torn down with great enthusiasm for, you know, letting one analyst see another agency's crown jewels.
Yes, the connect the dots was the phrase of choice at the time.
Yeah, and I predicted in the second edition of my book that this would end in tears. The pendulum always swings back again. Now, I didn't have any idea that it would be anything like WikiLeaks. What I assumed would happen would be another Aldrich Ames-type event.
A mole.
Rick Ames was the head of counterintelligence in the CIA, and he basically sold all the Russian network to the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
I just assumed that once you've got the best part of 1 million people with access to top-secret information,
mm-hmm.
That some of the crown jewels would be leaked to the other side,
mm-hmm.
because human nature is like that. But as it turned out, it seems to have been a private first class who dumped the contents of CipherNet onto the unclassified networks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, that's something like that was bound to happen. And it's a lesson that needs to be heeded.
Mm-hmm.
The guys at MITRE wrote a report 3 or 4 years ago saying that the traditional way in which the USA and its allies has dealt with classified information, namely with the traditional levels of confidential, secret, top secret, is well past its sell-by date, and it should be replaced by a new mechanism, which is probably something like flexible compartmentation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, such an approach would have prevented, or at least mitigated, the kind of thing that we saw with WikiLeaks. And it's very important elsewhere, too. One of the problems we have in Europe is that we are much further down the road than Americans at sharing medical information.
I was just getting ready to go there. Perfect. Yep.
and in Scotland, where they put together a database of all 5 million Scots and made it available to all the doctors, nurses, and ambulance men. Within a matter of a month or so, there was a doctor in Montrose who had downloaded the records of Gordon Brown and Alex Salmond and Kirsty Wark, you know, the then British Prime Minister, the Scottish First Minister, a famous TV personality, and a whole bunch of sports stars and others. Mm-hmm. And this was so embarrassing that in the end they decided not to prosecute him. But we're now heading for the same thing in England, with similar systems being built here.
Yep.
And in Finland, where there was a similar type of incident, the matter went to the European Court of Human Rights, which said that we Europeans have a right to restrict our personal medical information to the teams who are involved in our care.
We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, you might check out my monthly security column on InformIT. I've collected all the columns I've written over the last 5 years on my website at sigital.com/GEM. Or you can do a quick search under security at InformIT. Thanks for listening. So there are some people who claim, and I know your views on this from your publications, that if we just anonymize everything, that we can protect the individual privacy rights of people, but we can also garner some benefits from the common of all anonymized records. What are the challenges there?
It is very, very difficult to anonymize medical information in any way that leaves it still useful for research. Mm-hmm. Now, this was figured out 30 years ago by Dorothy Denning and her colleagues when they looked at the U.S. Census. And back in the mid-1990s, LaTanya Sweeney showed that it was very easy to re-identify VA medical records that had been supposedly scrubbed and put in the public domain.
Mm-hmm. Set theory, right?
it's basically set theory plus a bit of common sense. And the problem we have in Britain is that we've got a guy in charge of our government's transparency initiative, which is in charge of putting non-controversial government data online, who has gotten himself an enthusiasm for de-identifying things like medical records and making them available too. Mm-hmm. And it may be a long and hard job to educate our policymakers in Whitehall about how difficult anonymization actually is.
Right.
And I fear it's going to take some disasters before attention is paid. Mm-hmm. We've already seen something like 8 million people's medical records being stolen on a laptop from a researcher in North London.
Yeah, and we see the same thing here in the States. The same exact tension exists, and the same push to, I would say, compress the value chain of medical delivery by information technology without thinking about privacy and compartmentalization and all the things that we've been discussing.
Well, my prediction is that sooner or later, somebody is going to get hold of a lot of supposedly de-identified medical records, perhaps the UK's entire set, although for selfish reasons, I hope it's the set from some other country. and they'll put it on WikiLeaks or wherever.
Yeah.
And then journalists will figure out how to re-identify these records in a great many cases and answer questions about celebrities.
Yes, it'll probably be Murdoch's people doing that, one would imagine.
Well, we've got there's some similar work, for example, that we did and that we've got at Financial Cryptography at the end of next month. We looked at Facebook's new system for authenticating people by getting them to recognize photos of their friends.
Right.
And we found that that's not as strong as you might like, because for most people, the people from whom you require privacy are just your friends.
Right.
If the average person is committing adultery, then the only people who are concerned are, you know, him and his wife and their close friends.
Right.
Some random person at the other side of the world is just not interested at all.
One of whom is probably the adulterer.
Well, hey, and so the problem in social networks is that your enemies are close.
Right.
And if I can impersonate you, Gary, by just recognizing three or four of your friends, Well, you know, we meet at conferences from time to time. We move in the same circles. You know, I haven't checked your particular Facebook profile, but I think it's a good bet that I could recognize a fair number of your friends.
You'd have a hard time finding it because I don't have one.
Hey, lucky you.
I'm one of the six people on Earth left who without a Facebook page.
But it is a problem for the next generation. Yeah. We did some stuff on this because 3 years ago, a couple of my students came and said, look, we better do some Facebook privacy work. And I said, well, why? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, you guys don't understand, you old guys, but for our generation, Facebook is essential. It's not optional. They said, because all the party invitations in Cambridge come via Facebook. So if you're not on Facebook, you don't go to parties. That's you don't right. meet any girls. So you don't meet any. You don't get any sex. So you don't have any kids. So your genes will die out.
That's right. It's just social Darwinism at work.
Exactly.
I know that Zuckerberg is smiling when he listens to this. Right. So
hey.
In the last amount of time left, I want to talk about time a little bit. So time is a crucial factor in all systems and has been subject to waves of attention that, you know, come and go in the literature from talk to protocol analysis and having clocks that are certified. And yet time and state issues only rarely make the software security radar, which is odd considering that we have all sorts of multi-threaded systems and reentrant code is something we should be thinking about every second. So what can we do to fix that?
Well, people need to be more aware of the assumptions that they're relying on in cryptographic protocols. If you're relying on a random number being fresh, you'd better generate it yourself. And if you're relying on a timestamp being correct, you'd better have some way of verifying that too.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, there are all sorts of hideous attacks that happen on systems because people are forever building bad random number generators, and clocks are forever being reset to 1980 or 2000 or whenever.
Yep.
And if it's possible to break systems by lying about the time or by causing random number generators to fail in machines that the affected party doesn't control, then it just becomes too easy.
Well, let me give you an example from kind of the edge of finance. The money guys are leveraging time in picosecond and dark pools trading today and making vast, vast quantities of money very, very quickly. So when will we see a bloom in timing-based attacks on those high finance systems, do you think?
Well, if you can find some way to cheat by placing foreknowledge bets, then of course you're well away. So perhaps there are already frauds going on at market makers,
mm-hmm.
which work by them actually front-running their clients' trades.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's already known that front-running is one of the ways in which unscrupulous investment banks make their money. And if all you've got to do is delay a client trade by a few milliseconds and get in just faster.
Yeah, it's not milli anymore. It's pico now. So it's very interesting.
There are also significant forensics issues, which we've come across in some of the control systems work we've done. If you've got an outage of, say, a segment of the North American electricity grid, if stuff falls over,
mm-hmm.
Then whose fault was it? Who do you sue?
Mm-hmm.
You've got all the various substations running their own clocks, which, you know, could be minutes or even hours out. You just don't have the fine-grained, you know, millisecond resolution data that you have to reconstruct the chain of events and apportion blame.
Right.
And then, of course, the security economist in me kicks in and says, well, if I'm advising one of these utilities, I would tell them that under no circumstances whatsoever should they ever purchase an atomic clock, because it could end up making you very, very liable. And then,
exactly.
Of course, if you're the regulator, then there's another set of considerations.
You know, so in the future, we're going to have the time police. There's no question about it.
I think that rather than having a time police...
Oh, wait a minute. We'll call them the time static brigands.
Well, if you're in favor of big state solutions, then you could try that. But if you don't favor big state solutions, you could try going for Lamport time. Mm-hmm. That is, for looking which event happened after which other event and trying to engineer all your systems around that.
Mm-hmm.
Because security engineering is about getting rid of as much of the attack surface as you can. And if the attack surface includes an awful lot of clocks that you don't control, then it's worth some effort to try and make your system not depend on them anymore.
Right. All right, one last topic. So Stuxnet, good or bad?
Stuxnet, well, I've got no objection to people trying to delay Iran's acquisition of the bomb. So from that point of view, it was good. Mm-hmm. And from the point of view of the funding available to cybersecurity in Britain, it's also been hugely good, because it sufficiently scared the government off its butt that they come up with another £500 million. Mm-hmm. Now, the great majority of that was eaten by GCHQ, and only £30 million found its way to the police. Mm-hmm. But our police cybercrime units were badly underfunded, and so inefficient as the outcome was, it's still to be welcomed.
Right, right. So, you know, it looks like the UK shares some similarities with the US in terms of obsession with cyber war over cybercrime.
This is a very, very serious policy issue, because not only is the world globalizing, but the difference between civilian and military is just fading away, right? Military technologies used to be quite separate things that came off separate supply chains of different companies. But now, of course, the soldiers are using laptops just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And although they may be painted green, you know, they're running Windows or Linux or whatever like everybody else's laptop. And the sort of things that the military used to think were normal, routine, okay, become an awful lot less okay when you're using civilian tools and civilian infrastructure. I think that an awful lot of policy thinking has got to be done on this. And certainly we've got to shift the balance seriously away from cyber war and towards cyber policing. Mm-hmm. Because, you see, what we've got is, in effect, a swamp of all the botnets and malware and poor OPSEC procedures and bad design and so on. And within that swamp, there swim some crocodiles that are directed by government agencies. Now, from the point of view of maximizing social welfare, what we want to be doing is draining the swamp by means of things like breach disclosure laws and increasing software liability and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But so long as the center of gravity of government policy is not with the people who want to drain the swamp, but the people who want to breed bigger and better crocodiles,
right,
we're never going to get the right policy.
Right.
You see, the U.S. government does not have it in its interest at present to bully Microsoft into writing more secure software, because then it would be harder for the NSA to write zero-day exploits of computers in China.
And yet I think it was all of our mothers who collectively said, you shouldn't throw rocks in your glass house.
Exactly so. And you shouldn't run classes in poisoning the well in case some other person comes along and poisons yours.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, super. This has been a very interesting conversation. One last question. What's your favorite piece of current music?
Piece of current music. Oh, hey, that's hard to say. I've been recently playing in some English sessions and listening to accordion tunes and Morris tunes and trying to translate them to the pipes. That's a bit of a minority interest, though.
Yeah, accordion and pipes together is a little worrisome. Throw in a banjo and you have apocalypse, I'm pretty sure.
Hey.
Thanks, Ross. This has been great.
Thanks, Gary.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Inform IT. The November-December issue of IEEE S&P is a special issue on Living Within Security, edited by Deb Frenke and Bill Arbaugh. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.